I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a London Review of Books podcast.
One afternoon in Sana'a, last November, two lawyers in suit pushed with purpose through the doors of the Yemeni Tax Authority, a temple of nepotism and corruption. Several pairs of eyes followed them as they walked briskly down the corridor. The white walls rubbed into grimy grey by the backs of those condemned to spend hours waiting in this purgatory of bureaucratic torment. People watched disbelievingly as the two men marched past the camouflage-clad armed guards into the office of the director himself. This was a place which no one could enter without the proper connections and or a hefty bribe. The functionaries who tried to block the lawyer's passage shriveled and scuttled away when the younger of the two uttered the sacred words, "We are here on behalf of the legal wing of the Supreme Revolutionary Committee of Ansarullah." Ansarullah is the official name of the Houthis, the revolutionary movement which had recently taken over Sana'a, and the authority of the two lawyers emanated not from the single pistol they had between them, but from the tens of thousands of militiamen who had entered the capital with them. The office, with its massive glass-topped desk and leather sofas, was rather different from the shabby corridors outside. The lawyers sat themselves down, the director offered them tea, a lackey tried to smooth their. "We want the names of all the big businessmen who aren't paying their taxes," the younger of the lawyers said. Sheepishly, the director tried to explain that he wasn't actually in control of the tax office, that his employees were in reality there to serve the businessmen they were supposed to tax, that the tax authority wasn't in the business of collecting taxes so much as involved in a game of negotiations between impoverished functionaries and the wealthy few, until a bribe was paid and tax demands were reduced to pittance. The two lawyers looked bored. They had just come from a press conference in which they had declared that the Supreme Revolutionary Committee had exposed major graft and issued decrees confiscating the wealth of Hamid al-Ahmar, scion of the grandest tribal family in Yemen and a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Houthis' ideological enemies. They were hungry for more ammunition to use against them. "We will examine all the files," the older lawyer said. "Let me tell you about another type of corruption I uncovered when I was the head of the Port Customs Department," the director said, trying to wiggle out. "It's to do with bras." "Bras?" "Yes, bras. Some are very expensive luxury brands, not the usual red and pink you see in street stores. But when they declare them, they say they are cheap to avoid paying customs fees. We have other brothers whose job is to inspect shipments and customs. Can we see the files?" the lawyer said. After another hour of negotiations, subtle threats, and assurances of cooperation, they left, having secured an agreement that no forms would be signed, no tax declaration cleared, no decisions approved without the permission of a representative of the Supreme Revolutionary Committee. The director and possibly the whole system would soon be rendered obsolete. Early last year, the Houthis, followers of a revivalist anti-Western cleric, moved out of the northern highlands and marched south towards Sana'a, promising to end corruption, to fight Al-Qaeda, challenge U.S. hegemony. Al-Qaeda and the Americans were allies in the subjugations of Muslims, they said, and raise Yemenis out of poverty and powerlessness into a shining and more dignified future. In 2011, President Saleh had been toppled to be replaced by his deputy, the aloof Abdurrabbah Mansour Hadi, who had allowed al-Islah, the Yemeni branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, to control many offices of state. One crony kleptocratic elite had made way for another. Yemen wanted change, and the Houthis faced little or no resistance. The Houthis marched towards Sana'a slowly, but with determination. They laid siege to sectarian rivals, fought tribal leaders aligned with those rivals, and outmaneuvered their own allies. Towns fell before their troops. Army bases surrendered or switched allegiance without much of a fight, and the houses of those who dared to oppose them were demolished with explosives. In mid-September, they built protest camps around Sana'a, ostensibly to demonstrate against a planned hike on fuel prices, but effectively laying siege to the city. The army did what it usually does and shot and killed several demonstrators. 2 days later, on 21st of September, after defeating tribal and military units affiliated with Muslim Brotherhood, Sana'a went down without much of a crash or a thud. The UN Special Envoy and the President came up with an agreement that enshrined the Houthis as the new masters of the city. And to preserve the facade of the political process and safeguard their jobs, they declared that in every other way it was business as usual. With the help of popular committees representing their military wing, the Houthis raided and blockaded ministries, scrutinized bank accounts and removed ministers and officials from their office. They even confiscated that sacred scepter of the state, the departmental rubber stamps. The state was held hostage. The Supreme Revolutionary Committee became the authority that wielded political power and was housed in the city center in a white hotel building with square balconies and green stone cornicing. From the early hours of the morning until late at night, a motley crowd came and went through its gates. They included farmers seeking to address injustices inflicted by wealthy landlords, tribal leaders pledging allegiance, maverick politicians seeking position in the new administration, or businessmen looking for ways to avoid punishment. Even tribesmen who had long bickered over blood feuds came seeking a solution. Everyone wanted absolution from the new rulers of Sana'a. In the hotel's neon-lit corridors, shoes and flip-flops were heaped outside rooms that were busy with debates and meetings. On the top floor, in a plain white room, sat the head of the Supreme Revolutionary Committee, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, a cousin and brother-in-law of Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the current overall leader of the movement. A big man with a permanent infant-like smile, he crouched cross-legged behind a low table, sifting through documents. A Kalashnikov rested against the wall next to him. He opened a plastic shopping bag, pulled out a thick pile of papers, and started throwing them on the floor in front of him, like a dealer cutting a new set of cards. Each sheet represented a corruption case that was draining Yemen's coffers and putting another burden on his shoulders. One was a letter showing that a departmental head in the Ministry of Education had sold off some of his furniture for $435 to save costs, and then awarded himself a bonus of $523. Another civil servant had misappropriated $2,000 that was meant for schools. And then there was a gas and oil contract with the French company Total, worth $2.5 billion, that had been under investigation by the government long before the Houthis entered Sana'a. Everything had been gathered in the one plastic bag, and now lay on the floor at his feet. "When we entered Sana'a, we never expected to be solving all these problems," Muhammad Ali told me. "There is an octopus of corruption in the ministries. It's trying to prevent us from working. But we have an intelligence network that sends us reports of corruption from inside the ministries themselves. People come to us with their problems. We don't charge anything. This is pure volunteer work. We want to solve problems quickly. Those who work in government want to delay in order to make money." He was one of the movement's early members and had spent more than 3 years in prison. I asked him where a military commander had got the expertise to handle corruption cases. He smiled more broadly. "I was in the mountains and now I'm here. We're simple people. How did we get this far?" He marveled at his movement's achievement. "We don't have big houses. We don't have villas. We are poor people." He dismissed the UN sanctions against him personally and other senior Houthis, as well as the foreign embassies which had recently pulled out of Sana'a. They were mere gestures. "We aren't worried about our bank accounts and resources. Let them impose sanctions. We don't have bank accounts. We were even banned from having ID cards. We live on the contributions of our members. If you're dependent on the outside for funding, you will collapse. That is what happened to many revolutionary movements. You cut their support and they have to back down." A few weeks later, at the end of January, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi would become the head of state, and pictures of the shy, bulky man sitting in the president's seat would spread on social media as the definitive sign of the Houthis' takeover.
Thanks for listening. For more, go to lrb.co.uk.